guess we're going to go ahead and get started. I hope to show some slides just sort of to set the scene, but the slides won't work out, but we'll put them on the screen. And actually, before we begin, I did want to call up a friend of mine to sort of do an invocation to begin the reading, to set the scene. So I have a wonderful Lower East Side, a poet laureate here. Slemma Williams. Slemma is going to do a little recitation for us to begin.
Night glide. Hanging out in the streets, look for something to eat and a place to sleep. The police are everywhere. It seems the police are protecting the drug dealers here and there. Demonstrators with their banners and slogans demanding that bills are passed. Who knows how long the bills will last. Stolen cars on the street. The only people who are benefiting are the car strippers. Night gliders, the streets at night where anything is possible. Night gliders, the streets at night where anything is possible. Night gliders, the streets at night where anything is possible. Buildings are abandoned, and yet there's hardly any space for people. And because of red tape, there's little money for the people who want to fix up these buildings, Gardens are constructed. And yet the these people are destroying the gardens. The government says that the city's going broke, and yet the salary for the workers is going up. Ha 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 ha. Isn't that a joke? Night gliders, the streets at night where anything is possible. Night gliders, the streets at night where anything is possible. Night gliders, the streets at night. With you and me, it's possible. Thank you.
Thank you, Slemma. And I think that's really an appropriate way to begin the reading. I don't know if the slides are going or not.
Yeah.
But the book is Low East Side. It's a novel. Some of you have borne with me over the many years that it took to actually bring this project to fruition. It is a story of the Lower East Side. It's about anarchism on the Lower East Side. Certainly not the full range of expression that anarchism has had historically, but sort of selected moments. And the story revolves around Catherine, who is a 17-year-old punk squatter living in an abandoned building. The story is set in the period that you see represented on the screen here, when the Lower East Side, and particularly the Low East Sida section, which is, of course, the avenues east of Avenue A over to Avenue D from 14th Street down to Houston, was a particularly devastated part of the neighborhood. Something on the order of 50% of all of the property in that section of the Lower East Side was abandoned, and either vacant lots or abandoned buildings. So it's very different from what you see when you walk in that neighborhood today. And the story traces Catherine's development. It's sort of a coming-of-age story. She becomes involved in a struggle to save a community garden, begins to work with the Puerto Rican community around that. And at the same time, she's exploring her family history by getting to know her great-grandmother, who's in a nursing home on the Lower East Side, who was part of the Yiddish anarchist movement at the turn of the century. So that's sort of, in a nutshell, what the book is about. And I thought I'd read a chapter or two, and then we can have some discussion if folks want. So we'll begin at the beginning, chapter one. The East River is not really a river at all. It's a tidal strait, part of the larger Hudson River estuary, a wash that runs from Upper New York Bay to Long Island Sound. The estuary is where life emerged out of the ancient ocean, where species mutate and change is born. The womb, mother of all, bearer, maker, container of boundless life burrowing in her mud, birth and death endlessly cycling through her depths, expressing the powers of sun, earth, stone, water, and ice. It is fecund beyond measure, the edge, where the Laurentide glacier ended and salt water and fresh water merge, the margin between land and sea. Silver shadows shine just below the dark surface, teeming by the billions, reaching for the sea, newly hatched and defenseless against gulls, terns, and cormorants, but trusting to the beneficent, mindless rhythm, answering only to the moon, drawing them inexorably outward and upward, east to ever greater mysteries and vastness beyond knowing. The one means nothing here, caught in the midst of the many, the small flicker for survival, a reflex, an instinct, their greatest hope, anonymity. And the big devour the small in an ancient choreography, a cycle, a meditation, a moment without despair or malice, all part of the whole and connected, indelibly marked by a web of discourse beyond language. On the shore stands a city full of people, born of the estuary but distinct, remaking the world in its image, yet still connected to the larger cycles that make everything possible. Nitrogen, oxygen, carbon dioxide, still bound to the tides, the sun, the moon, and the soil by the ancient web, growing ever more fragile. Here too change is born, but here the one matters, struggling for solace, recognition, connection, redemption, their highest aspiration. The garden, damn it, Mike, they can't take the garden. The wind off the river rattled the window of Catherine's small room. I don't believe it, she threw down the metro section of the Times. $50 million, 500 units, all for the yuppies. Mike, his voice heavy with sleep, poked his head over the edge of the loft. What? The garden. They're going to tear up the garden and build apartments. Where do they expect us to go? They don't care. They just assume we ended up in the East River. That doesn't help, Michael, she glared at him. I'm serious. She fussed with a strand of hair that had escaped from under her beret. Money talks, bullshit walks. Mike, come on. Well, what are you going to do? Write graffiti? Oh, yeah, that'll stop him for sure. Michael, don't be pissed at me. It's not my fault. I'm not pissed at you, but if you don't start taking this seriously, I mean, dude, it's the garden. Doesn't that matter to you? All the great times we had? I mean, like, how can you be so laid back? What does it take to get you going? What are you so uptight about it? Uptight? I'm not uptight. I'm angry. There's a big difference. Oh, yeah? What's the difference? Duh. The difference is uptight is you, just uncomfortable, but not enough to do anything. Angry means I'm ready to do something. I'm gonna do something. What? You gonna stop the city? Come on, Kathy, get real. She was on her feet now, pacing back and forth beneath the bare light bulb that swung gently in the draft from the window. Mike, high-rise towers. We need the guard. Why not fix up the abandoned buildings? I'm not just going to sit back and let them take it away. We'll organize. We can use the paper to get the word out. I've been working on a story about the garden anyway. Great, Mike rolled his eyes. Now you are starting to piss me off. What, you think we should just let them have it? Oh, that's right. You're Mr. Mellow. Don't worry. It'll be cool. Well, I don't think so, dude. They can't just take the garden. Oh, you're going to fight the city? Yeah, and I'll stop them. You and who else? Me, myself, and I. And I bet there are lots of other people in the neighborhood who feel the same if you won't get off your ass to help. You really are the patron saint of lost causes. Fuck you, Michael. The article in the paper was the last straw. Everything was falling apart. Con Ed was hassling them. Her job sucked, and now this. She pulled on her leather jacket. Where are you going? Out, she scowled at him over her shoulder as she walked toward the front room. Obviously. Out where? To the avalanche. She slammed the door behind her and took the dilapidated stairs two at a time. Catherine shivered, pummeled by a blast of cold air when she stepped out onto Avenue D. She turned up the collar on her jacket and walked toward the park. A gust of wind at her back hurried her on her way. She walked down 9th Street, a gray ribbon that unfurled straight before her for two blocks to its brown terminus at Tompkins Square Park. Why was Mike being such an asshole? There was a crew of dealers who worked out of the corner bodega with empty shelves, trolling the block for customers. They wore down parkas, North Face, with wool caps pulled over their ears against the cold. She walked through them with her head down and her eyes focused on the sidewalk, ignoring their muttered offers of rocks and the really good shit. She strode toward a vacant lot where a building stood just a few days before. It had collapsed, another neighborhood victim of neglect and abuse, and its death had filled the lot with a small mountain of bricks. People's lives were still visible in the rubble. A high-heeled shoe, red satin peeling, stuck out of the pile. A baby doll with a crushed head lay on the ground next to pieces of an old kitchen range. She stopped for a moment to stare. Three men, swaddled in tattered layers, were in the lot, poking around for anything of value that had survived the building's collapse. Their shopping cart held a few dented pots and pans, some old books, and a broken lamp. The lot seemed to be oozing cold, and she shivered again as she walked by. Sometimes she really hated Mike. What did he mean, patron saint of lost causes? How could he just write off the garden like that? Despite the weather, two young Latino men lingered outside the graffiti-filled storefront of a social club, smoking cigarettes and drinking from cans of Budweiser. Sounds of salsa exploded when the door of the club opened onto the street, and for a moment the rhythm made her want to dance, until the sullen stares of the young men brought her back down to earth. She was used to being stared at. Beneath her battered old motorcycle jacket with a turned-up collar, a shapeless black sweater hung almost to her knees. Purple tights and a pair of black paratrooper boots completed her outfit. Her hair, cut to frame her thin face, and today the same shade of purple as her tights, stuck out from under a black beret that sat at a jaunty angle, drawing attention to high cheekbones, large gray eyes, and full lips. A gold ring pierced her nose and another her eyebrow. Catherine ignored the men's looks and kept walking. She passed a botanica, its window full of red, blues, and yellows, religious statuary, bright bottles of herbal tinctures, and hanging bundles of dried herbs. Scented candles burned behind the glass, and Catherine could smell their perfume. She had always wanted to go into the little shop, walk by it nearly every day, but she never did, fearful of violating some unspoken Puerto Rican taboo. She and Mike had been fighting for weeks. Why was everything so hard? The wind rattled the lids on the trash cans that lined the street. On a tenement, its windows and doors sealed by plywood sheets bearing the stenciled message, "Keep Out," a remnant of yellow tape, "Police Line, Do Not Cross," hung from the cast iron banister of the building entry, flapping in the breeze freshening off of the river. Outlined on the steps in yellow chalk was the shape of a person, a grim reminder that, as the fresh graffiti on the plywood proclaimed, crack rules. A player ran out of time last week. Willie, a member of the street corner crew Catherine had just passed. She could only guess who put the 9mm slug into his head, splattering his brains on the steps of the abandoned building. An irate customer, perhaps. A distributor who thought he was holding out. Maybe a runner or a lookout who wanted to move up in the organization. Or it might have been a ripoff by another dealer or a turf battle. She would never know. The cops had stopped looking by now. They'd just as soon let the crack dealers kill each other off. Catherine averted her eyes as she walked by the reddish-brown stain on the bluestone stair treads. Why was Mike always putting her down, making her feel like a little girl? She was fucking 17. A man came towards her, looking crazy and shouting at her in Spanish. She recoiled momentarily and then stepped around him. What did he want? He was an old man with 3 or 4 days' growth of beard covering his blotchy face. She had noticed him before, shuffling through the streets of the neighborhood day after day. It looked like there was a pint of Old Duke riding in the pocket of his dirty trousers. A common wino at first glance, one of many who slept on the stoops and dozed in the sun on Tompkins Square Park's wrought iron benches. But his eyes set him apart. Instead of being dull and yellowed, they were dark and shining, and drew her into his grizzled face. And in his back pocket, flush against his sagging buttocks, rode not a bottle, but a notebook. He wore a metal helmet, maybe surplus from some war. He had painted it blue, the color of the sky on a clear day, and in white lettering had written El Arbol Que Habla. His name was Enrique Langdon, and whenever he could engage the interest of a passerby, like Catherine, even for a moment, he recited a poem. Catherine didn't get it. What did he want? What was he shouting? those bright eyes staring at her, and all that passion in his voice. Kind of spooky. She passed by the next storefront down, a gallery, one of several that had opened on the block earlier in the 80s, a few years before Catherine had moved to the neighborhood. One night in the fall, when she had passed by, an opening had been in full swing there. A limo disgorged guests, a jazz quartet played in the gallery, and the party spilled out onto the sidewalk, the guests sipping wine from plastic goblets, laughing among the tenements and the abandoned buildings. A group of them sat on the stairway where the yellow chalk outline now served as a memorial for the murdered crack dealer. Neon constructions exploded in the gallery window, pinks, greens, and oranges, mocking the grayness of the day and the neighborhood. Too commercial, Mike had sneered when they had first strolled together along 9th Street on a warm Sunday afternoon last spring. It's already just like Soho or 57th Street down here. He was an artist, but she watched the shows come and go herself, made up her own mind, and sure enough, found little that appealed to her. Catherine stopped and glanced at the window. She questioned almost everything she experienced. She was always on the outside, observing, never liking what she saw enough to become a part of it, at least not until she'd started hanging out on the Lower East Side. In eighth grade, she decided that the life of a suburban princess was not for her. Drugs, sex, and rock and roll, they all led straight to the Lower East Side. It was dangerous, it was erotic, and it was not Scarsdale. She started coming down on weekends, on days when she and her friends cut school. They poked around the shops on St. Mark's Place and Avenue A, and on nice days, they would hang out in Tompkins Square. She was bored by MTV and in constant battles with her parents. She shut herself in a room and spent hours listening to the tapes she searched out on her forays into the Lower East Side. The music spoke to her, feelings and ideas she could never explain to them. She wrote it all in her zine, but she never let them see it. She was cynical, angry, and fed up with the hypocrisy she saw all around her. The Lower East Side was a magnet for her and others like her, the place to be. It promised adventure and excitement, a romantic bohemia where she could escape the boredom and hopelessness of her life in the suburbs. It was a place to find something essential that was missing in Scarsdale. In the park and on the avenue, she found kids she liked. Kids who felt the way she did, were into the same bands, and had a kind of fuck you attitude towards the world. They called themselves anarchists, but it was more of a feeling than anything else. At first, it just meant freedom to her, freedom not to be who she was expected to be, but to define herself on her own terms. Her parents didn't get it. They freaked out and sent her to see a shrink. ODD, oppositional defiance disorder, he told her parents. She had laughed. The garden, the cause of her current anger, the spot where they hung out in the warmer weather, was just ahead. A sign done in graffiti style read El Jardin, but they just called it the garden. The large vacant lot had been turned into a vest pocket park years earlier, long before she had moved to the neighborhood, with a few cast iron benches and an amphitheater board built into a hill made of rubble. Willow trees shaded a small lawn in the summer. The sides of the surrounding buildings, some occupied and some abandoned, were covered with brightly colored murals. It was their patch of green in the gray of the city. When it was warm enough, there was always something happening there. It was where she and Mike first hooked up, sharing a joint in a circle with Raven and the others while some Billy Idol wannabe strummed his guitar. Didn't any of that matter to Mike? El Jardin was empty today, except for a young Puerto Rican couple pushing a blue baby stroller and an older child riding around on a plastic tricycle with a giant front wheel. The baby was crying, the kid on the bike was screaming with excitement. They looked cold. It was the heart of the scene for her and her friends, their spot in an often hostile neighborhood. No way the city was going to take it away from them. No fucking way. Catherine paused in front of the gate to the garden for a moment. Then she swallowed hard and crossed Avenue C, walking faster. The paper must be off the press by now, waiting in the basement office. The glow of the computer screen would hypnotize her as she entered words where she might lose all track of time and some nights without knowing it, would work past dawn, coming out of the basement into the shock of daylight. I don't think I mentioned she works on an underground newspaper. Catherine gazed over her shoulder for a last lingering look at the garden as she approached a four-story townhouse. It had a fresh coat of tan paint and eggplant trim that highlighted the building's marble columns topped with gargoyles. The massive oak door had shiny brass hardware. Window boxes with miniature boxwood hedges hung from the second floor. The house looked like it belonged in a fancier neighborhood, Greenwich Village or Gramercy Park. "Yuppie scum," muttered Catherine under her breath as she walked past. A church stood next to a tenement that seemed to overflow with crying children and their screaming mothers. Outside the church was a hand-painted sign that read, "Free lunch, Monday through Saturday, 12 p.m. Though not quite 11, there was a line that extended down the block and around the corner opposite Tompkins Square. All kinds of people, all standing quietly. It was hard for her to walk by them, to see their faces. A black man stood there staring at the ground, a troubled crease in his forehead. A skinny white girl Catherine had seen turning tricks on Third Avenue also waited patiently. Her right leg was encrusted in a grimy cast, and a quietly sobbing three-year-old boy dangled from one of the girl's crutches. Catherine pushed down her beret and crossed the street to the north side. Tears welled up in her eyes. She still hadn't learned to selectively attend to the suffering around her, an urban survival skill too easily acquired by most. Her back stiffened when she thought about the injustice of it all. She saw the storefront offices of Action for Housing and stopped to look in the window at an artist's glossy rendering of the three high-rise towers they planned to build in the garden. Catherine imagined a bulldozer tearing up the grass and uprooting the willows, the amphitheater crushed by its treads. She flushed, tightened her fist, and blood pounded in her temple. The interior of the office was dark, no sign of life. She looked up and down the block. No one was watching her. There was no one around except the people online in front of the church soup kitchen, and they wouldn't care. Catherine unsnapped the top pocket of her motorcycle jacket, pulled out a black felt marker, and wrote "Poverty Pimps Out" in bold script under the storefront's window. She would show them, and Mike, too. She stormed away from the office, cruising by a large, dingy building that was once the neighborhood's elementary school and now housed La Cabana Community Center. She and Mike had gone to some events there, an exhibit of work by some local artists, a performance by the Lower East Side Puppet Theater in the basement auditorium, and once or twice to the films that they showed last summer. But she really didn't know what else went on there. It was a huge building, and there were always lots of people going in and out. Most of them were Puerto Ricans. She wished that she spoke Spanish or something. Their lives were a mystery to her. She saw them coming and going at the community center, and they looked like they belonged there. She envied them that sense of belonging. It was as though they lived in parallel universes, not really touching her own. On the corner of Avenue B, directly across from Tompkins Square Park, she stood in front of the Cristadora house, waiting for an opening in the traffic. She watched as a husky black guy wearing a blue uniform and a hat trimmed with gold braid swung open the entrance for a young woman in a fur coat. Catherine glared at her, and the fur-clad woman got the message, averting her eyes and walking a little faster toward the waiting BMW. Catherine laughed to herself, but she was bothered by some vague memory of the woman's face, and after a moment thought that maybe they'd gone to the same high school, though the girl in the fur would have had to have been a few years ahead of her. She turned a scornful eye towards the departing car. A triplex apartment with a rooftop garden in the Cristadora had been featured in the Sunday Times style section a few months earlier. It was rumored in the neighborhood that the apartment had sold for over $1.5 million. $1.5 million, and they looked out their window at the church soup kitchen, the crackheads and junkies, and the abandoned buildings that still lined the block. Catherine shook her head. At the eastern entrance to Tompkins Square, a group of black and Hispanic men huddled around a 55-gallon drum that held a blazing fire, listening to someone rapping out of a boombox. Catherine wanted to stop and warm herself there, but she knew it was a bad idea. Instead, she walked across the almost deserted park, rubbing her gloveless hands together to ward off the cold. A police car cruised slowly past the restrooms and the entrance to the kiddie pool closed for the season. Bare trees blended with brown grass and the bleakness of the city. The wind whipped a discarded newspaper around her feet. The scene was very different from her memory of the same promenade in the summer under a canopy of green leaves, the walkway dappled with sunlight. A cold gust of wind brought her back to reality as she watched two bearded men pass a bottle encased in a brown paper bag between them. Not great weather to be homeless. She was thankful for a squat, as funky as it might be. At least it was warm and dry. Catherine exited through the gates of the park's west side and waited for the light to change. Horns were honking, and an ambulance was trying to make its way across the intersection, with its siren shrieking at the indifferent drivers. It seemed like an eternity before the traffic signal turned green and she flew across the avenue, heading for the basement office of the Avalanche. She could read the huge headline posted on the door all the way from the corner of 9th Street. Lower East Side Shining Path declares class war. So that's chapter one. Would people like to hear a little more? I think we have time.
There are seats over here.
And there are seats. Please join us. And thanks to everyone for coming. Appreciate it. Chapter from early in the book. It's sort of self-explanatory, right? but this is where she first finds out what's really going on with the girl.
I just can't hear that well back there.
I'm sorry. Are people able to hear? Should I read louder?
It's
all right. Just us old guys. Who Me too. All right. So this is actually chapter three. A Puerto Rican man stood in front of the door of La Cabana Community Center. He glanced around the open door of the old elementary school. He was a big man, tall and solid. His black hair was pulled back tightly into a ponytail, and dark eyes flashed beneath heavy brows and a broad forehead. The sharp, chiseled features of his Taino Indian ancestors. While not handsome in a conventional way, his was a face people did not soon forget. His name was Carlos Santiago, but he was known in the neighborhood as Chico. He walked into the open lobby. White walls were hung with large canvases, tropical hues, pastel greens, blues, and pinks, the work of a neighborhood artist. The building had come a long way in 15 years. No more graffiti-painted walls, peel and plaster, or mounds of garbage. Everyone had said that it was too big a job for them, everyone but Chico. At first, the city fought them, sending in the cops. The housing department put a padlock on the door of the abandoned school. That night, he and the others returned and clipped the lock. The police came back the next day. It went on like that for a week or so. Then one day, the cops were met by a crowd of about 300 people carrying signs and raising clenched fists in the air. They backed off after that. Chico's group had squatted in the school building ever since, fixing it up little by little, using whatever they could to keep things going. They did a lot there now, after school programs and tutoring, basketball, in the old gym, and their cultural and arts programs, poetry, folkloric dancing, theater, music, art exhibits, and a film series. Chico and a crew of youngbloods had plastered the neighborhood with Xerox posters calling for the meeting tonight. The first few folks came into the lobby from the Block Association. Hey, como estas? Thanks for coming. People trickled into the basement auditorium in ones and twos. When 7:30 came around, the hall held almost 100, mostly people he knew, but a few others. Down front was a guy with a shaved head and a black leather jacket who hung around in El Jardin. A tall, young girl with purple hair who he had noticed walking on the block just yesterday was sitting in the fifth row, near the neatly dressed man who had bought the townhouse across the street. Chico walked to the lectern. The room had a musty smell, and with the lights on, he could see the green paint starting to peel from the walls. His family had come to the Lower East Side when he was 8 years old, speaking no English. He remembered the kosher butchers and delicatessens giving way to bodegas and botanicas along Avenue C. His father had pushed a hand truck in the garment district, and his mother worked in a plastics factory in Brooklyn. He was terrified, humiliated, and later bored almost to death in this very auditorium. He left school in the ninth grade without knowing how to read or write. Chico half expected to hear a bell ring calling the assembly to order. The seats bolted to the floor in tidy rows were small, and the adults who filled them sat with their knees close to their chins, chattering among themselves like anxious children. "Listen up," Chico banged an empty water glass on the lectern to get their attention. "Let's get started. Thanks for coming. You know why we're here, to talk about the housing project they want to build in El Jardin. We got to make a decision before the city decides for us. Tonight we can speak our minds. Everybody will have a chance to talk, ask questions. If we don't have answers, we'll find them out. Then we figure out what we want to do next. This isn't the community board, no official members. Everybody here gets to vote. Doesn't mean the city's going to listen, probably not. Any questions?" No one spoke at first. Finally, a young Puerto Rican man with a pencil mustache stood up in the second row. "What's the deal, Chico? I mean, what's the problem, man? We've been waiting a long time for housing down here. They're finally going to build it, and some of you people want to stop them? I can't see that. We need the housing. It's for poor people, and that's that. Anyway, that's how I see it." A dozen voices suddenly filled the auditorium. "Hold it, hold it," Chico boomed out over the hubbub. "Raise your hands. Talk one at a time. Don't worry. Everybody will have a turn." He pointed to a middle-aged woman with curly hair in the first row, waving a white handkerchief, Luz Guerra. He knew her from the Block Association. She stood. "Sure, it's true, we need housing, but we also need gardens. Why can't they build on another lot, one filled with garbage, and leave El Jardin for the community? That's what I want to know." "What community?" A woman in back rows. "I can't even let my kids play over there no more. It's all full of people with green hair and winos. They always taking pot and acting crazy over there. I think we'd do much better with the housing." The crowd applauded, and the woman who had spoken sat back down. "Wait a minute," the guy with the shaved head, rings through his eyebrows, and a gold stud in his tongue jumped up. We live in the neighborhood, too. We got a right to hang out. It's a people's park. We don't do no hard drugs in there, and everybody needs some place they can party. Don't diss us. We got a stake here, too." "Sit down. Fuck you, asshole. Get out of our neighborhood. Go home." The cries rang out from all corners of the auditorium. The guy sank back in his seat. "Listen up. Listen up. People got to be respectful. Let everybody speak. And don't get loud. Take turns or this isn't going to work." Chico waited while the crowd calmed down. "I think it would be a good idea also if everybody said their names and where they live before they talk. That way we can get to know each other a little. Okay?" People listened to Chico. He was respected. He always had been, even when he was a kid. He had been a big boy, fearless and smart in every way but book learning. He rose through the ranks of his gang, the Dragons, fast. And at age 16, he became warlord, a leader, defending his neighborhood and his honor against enemies from cross town or other sections of the Lower East Side. The gang was the only chance he had to prove that he was somebody. "You next," he pointed to a Hispanic woman with gray hair poking out from beneath a colorful scarf. "Yo hablo solamente en español." "That's okay, you go ahead and talk, I'll translate for you." "Yo voy a traducir." "Her name is Maria. She says she's old and maybe what she wants isn't so important as the young people. But she remembers when we started El Jardin, and it was a beautiful garden, a real community place built by the people themselves. Now it's filling up with garbage again. She wonders why that is. Don't people have any pride? If we can't take care of it, maybe the city should take it away. Of course we need housing, but there are many other places to build. El Jardin used to be special. Why can't we make it special again? She remembers the first year when it was a garden. She grew tomatoes and peppers there. They reminded her of her own garden in Puerto Rico, and that was so nice. She watched while the Youngbloods painted the murals one summer. She loves the murals. What will happen to the murals if they build there? She wonders why they have to build there when there are so many other lots. She doesn't want more houses there. She wants grass and trees. What will happen to the willow trees she helped plant? They're big enough to give shade, to sit under now. Will she have to start over again somewhere else? She's too old to start over. She wants to stay here. When Chico finished translating, the applause was loud and long, broken by cries of Baya and speak on it, sister. She blushed crimson and sat down. Chico remembered the start of El Jardin too, a crisp fall day 18 years ago. He woke before dawn with a knot in his stomach. They had announced a work day to clean up a vacant lot on 9th Street where a kid was bitten by rats the week before. He worried that no one would come. The posters they put up promised food and entertainment, but they'd been too busy trying to chill out some static between a couple of local gangs to get anything together. He pulled on a pair of denim overalls while it was still dark and drove a battered old Volkswagen van he had borrowed down to the Fulton Street Fish Market. The market was bustling as the vendors were getting ready to close up shop for the day. You got any damaged fish or stock that you're going to throw away? He managed to collect enough fish, clams, oysters, and even some lobsters with broken shells to fill a large waxed cardboard box. He covered it with ice and hoisted it into the van, then headed back up the FDR Drive. The sun rose over the East River, a huge red ball hanging over the spires and spider-like cables of the Brooklyn Bridge, backlighting the Brooklyn skyline with a blood-red glow. He exited at Houston and drove up Avenue C to 9th Street. His crew arrived early, too. By 7 o'clock, there were a half dozen of them, four men and two young women, standing in the lot near a stack of shovels and rakes and a contractor's wheelbarrow that they'd borrowed from the Green Gorillas, a gardening group. Chico wondered if their plan was going to work as he stared at the pile of brick, old bed springs mingled with discarded television sets, last year's Christmas trees, and 10 years' worth of trash torn apart and spread all over by the rats that made the lot their home. There was nothing to do but get started. So they picked up rakes and shovels and began filling the garbage bags. Chico had convinced the owner of a local bodega to donate. Chico knew that they felt like it was hopeless. Hey, listen up, you do a good job with this lot and I get you all jobs with sanitation, $35,000 a year and you can move to Westchester. They laughed. Jorge, you've been looking all over for this, haven't you? He held up a tattered Raggedy Ann doll. You know the dogs stay out of this lot. They're scared because the rats are bigger than they are. The work found a rhythm punctuated by his jokes. He was convinced that the environment was a key to rebuilding the community. If they could make some physical order out of the mess of the decaying neighborhood, give people some space where they could relax and meet together, if they could build something that people could see, feel, and touch, it would show them that they could do for themselves. He saw it as a way to take a problem, garbage-strewn lot, and turn it into a resource for the neighborhood. Chico had talked a lot about his ideas with Jack Hoffman, an older white guy who lived on Fifth Street, so he was pleased when he saw him arrive and pick up a shovel, their first volunteer. Chico had heard Hoffman talk about the neighborhood as an ecosystem years before. After his time in prison, Chico was hungry for new ideas and radical alternatives. One day he picked up a book by Hoffman, Discourse on the Ecological City. And when Chico found out that the author lived in the neighborhood, he tracked him down. They became friends. Brother Jack, good to see you. Thanks for coming. Chico clapped him on the back. Man, I was getting worried nobody would show up. It's only 8, Chico. It's still early. Give it a while. It takes time. A few kids came over to watch what was going on, but they stayed outside the lot. A wino observed the work crew from a stoop across the street, sipping regularly from a bottle in a brown paper bag. Finally, a young family, mother, father, and their 10-year-old boy, came out of a building down the block. Chico went over to greet them. Hola, welcome. Believe it or not, this is going to be a beautiful park when we're done, a place where we can all relax and your son can come to play. They picked up rakes and started working. A few others joined them as the day warmed up. The garbage bags started to fill, but there was no other sign of progress. The pile of rubble still loomed. At around noon, Chico started a fire in a 55-gallon drum. Anybody hungry? You ready for lunch yet? He took a few chunks of halibut from the top of the box of fish and started to grill them on an old refrigerator shelf he had placed over the fire. Chico pulled a pocket knife from his overalls and used it to turn the fish. The smell of the grilling halibut brought a few more people to the lot. Some who had merely been onlookers, including a growing group of curious children, joined in the work. They piled bricks in one corner of the lot, scrap wood in the center, and kept filling trash bags and stacking them on the sidewalks in a growing heap. A young man with a bandana wrapped around his head arrived with a conga drum. "Vaya, Pedro," Chico shot a fist in the air from behind the grill. "You made it, comrade. Thank you, thank you." Pedro began to play. His drumming drew other congueros, who layered their rhythms on top of his, sending a pulsing beat up and down the block. A crowd gathered, and most joined the work crew. The lot, so grim just a few hours before, began to feel festive. The block was coming to life. Chico allowed himself to smile. The contours of the collapsed building's foundation were being slowly revealed, like an archaeological dig, as patches of earth were liberated from the tons of debris that had concealed them for almost a decade. A group of teenage girls began to dance an impromptu bomba in one of the cleared areas. Chico stepped out from behind the grill and danced a few steps with them. By now, there were dozens of people congregating in and around the lot, most of them working at least a little. Chico cooked and kept up his banter through the afternoon. Someone took up a collection and returned with a keg of beer as the shadows lengthened. By sunset, the lot was basically cleaned up. The brick was stacked to one side, and a mountain of bag garbage filled the sidewalk. When darkness fell, the scrap wood piled in the middle of the lot fed a fire in the 55-gallon drum. The block's residents ate fish, drank beer, talked, laughed, and danced by the light of the flames. Their shadows enlarged on the sides of the abandoned buildings around the lot. Chico stood before the fire, his back to the growing chill of the night. Chico sighed and pointed to a thin white man wearing gold-rimmed glasses and a dark blue suit. "My name is John, and I live here on the block. I appreciate what this woman just said, but you've got to be realistic. That lot is an eyesore. I'm sure it was very nice once, but it's a mess now, and the city is in no position to restore it. Believe me, I'm a financial analyst, and the city is broke. So if it's a question of housing or garbage, I'm all for housing. Let the market decide what the best use is for the property. There's room for everyone here in Alphabet City. That's what makes it such an exciting place to live. If a developer is willing to risk his capital investing in the neighborhood, he should have a right to make a profit. If people can't afford the rents here, let them move somewhere else. That's the way the world works. The era of socialism is over on the Lower East Side. We have a prime location here. Let's make the most of it. Let's attract a better class of people to the neighborhood. That can only help us all." Boos and hisses punctuated his remarks, but John persisted in a closing comment. "I don't appreciate this rudeness either. I happen to be a homeowner in this neighborhood, and I have as much right to be heard as anyone else." Then he sat down. "Die, yuppie scum. Gentry, get out. Cool it, people. Chill out." Eventually, the crowd calmed down, and Chico pointed to Catherine, sitting in the middle of the fifth row. She had seen a poster on a lamppost on 9th Street. She stood. "My name is Catherine, and I live in a squat down on Avenue D. Like, I'm really sick of hearing who can and who can't live in this neighborhood. Dudes, we've got to save the garden. My grandpa was born here, and my great-grandma still lives here, so I'm as much a part of this community as anybody in this room. Save the garden, save the squats." Someone from the rear of the hall called out, "Go back to the suburbs." Catherine returned to her seat, shaking. She'd come to the meeting to try to do something. First they'll take the garden, then they'll come after the squats. Then the gentrifiers will take over the whole neighborhood. People need to help each other, hang together. Otherwise it's all over. Why couldn't they see it? Catherine was not one of those suburban mall rats who hung around Sam Goody's waiting for the latest releases to show up on the shelves. She'd never felt comfortable confining herself to the tepid little world that her parents and friends from school expected her to live in. Perfect lawns and screwing the captain of the football team in the back seat of his Camaro just didn't excite her. They could not stop her from doing what she wanted, and what she wanted more than anything was to not be a part of their world. Strangely enough, she did feel like she belonged on the Lower East Side, at least as much as she belonged anywhere. Chica pointed to a man with flowing black hair and a full beard. "My name is Pedro, and I live in Lower East Side, not Alphabet City." He nodded toward the yuppie. "I am a poet, and I have this to say to the young lady who just spoke. I will support the squatters. I will support them when I see Puerto Ricans living in their buildings. I will support them when I see evidence of a real commitment to this community. I will support them when I see respect for my culture and support for our struggles. It's a two-way street, you know, young lady. When you show disrespect for us by the way you abuse El Jardín, it is hard for us to respect you. At the same time, I think we have a common interest in keeping El Jardín as an artistic and cultural resource for our community. While we desperately need housing, we also need poetry. And that is what El Jardín should be about. Don't ask me to choose. We need both, and we must have both. Poetry demands decent housing. Poetry eases our hunger and increases our thirst for life, but we also need roofs that don't leak and places to warm our bodies, not just our souls. Viva Loisaida. He tossed his dark mane and sat down to thunderous applause. Viva Loisaida. It was a balmy August night. Chica was 18. He and Santo, the president of the Dragons, were robbing an elderly Jewish man in the hallway of one of the co-ops on Grand Street. The man grabbed at Santo's arm, a feeble effort to resist, and Santo lunged at him with his 8-inch stiletto. Chico shouted no. They were both arrested. Chico sentenced to 10 years as an accessory. He served 3 in the state prison at Attica, where he was haunted by the vision of the old man lying in the hall with his blood draining into a growing pool on the floor. He never wanted to hurt the man. If he had been able to, he would have stopped it, but it was too late. And he kept seeing the vision. He knew something was wrong, and it had to change. He had to change. You mean to tell me you can't read, chump? How the hell are you ever going to learn anything? Joe Williams was a Black Panther and Chico's cellmate. You better get serious, get some discipline. Use this time to get yourself ready. We got important work to do on the outside, but you gotta be able to read. Damn, the man really fucked you around, didn't he? Joe taught Chico to read and write. He held political education classes in Attica with Panthers, weathermen, and Puerto Rican nationalists. The enemy is the system, the racist capitalist system. Brother Malcolm, Mao, Ho Chi Minh, Che, they got it right. Don't be wasting your time on bullshit. I'm fighting your brothers. The man wants you to do that. The enemy is the system. Don't forget it. If there was any chance Chica might forget, it ended after the riot and the murder of Joe and 50 others by Rockefeller and the state police. No, Chico couldn't forget, and by the time he came out, he was changed. He got off the bus from Attica and walked out of the terminal into Midtown. The city looked different to him. Concrete, granite, bricks, and mortar. The system was everywhere, choking out or paving over any trace of life. The streets were full of people, except they seemed like robots. But as he walked south and east, out of Midtown, through Union Square, and past Stuyvesant Village, he discovered pockets where lives still touched each other, where grass grew. Simple things breathed life back into people, and they connected with each other and the larger, all but forgotten cycles that make everything possible. He crossed 14th Street, and the vacuum was filled. The droning and emptiness gave way. Chico blinked in astonishment as the gray streets lined with gray buildings merged into the hot pinks and blues hanging from Loisaida's clotheslines. Free space, the graffiti proclaimed. The sharp angles, the rigid geometry of the rest of the city seemed to crumble into rubble and decay, soft edges revealed. A small tree grew through the remains of an old tenement. A white goat tethered in a building's backyard contentedly chewed the grass. Starlings chattered in an abandoned building. The neighborhood looked like it was transmuting, like when he helped his mother in her garden back in Puerto Rico. Compost overripe for turning. And hot with the odor of decay, rich soil for cultivation. He knew he had returned to his place, the margins where change happens, where energy is transformed and new species emerge, the edge, the source, the estuary where the river meets the sea. He felt it as he walked the streets late at night with his hands shoved deep in the pockets of his jeans. He saw it. He had always lived as much in the what could be as he did in the here and now, a dreamer. But his dreams had power. They were what sustained him, and they were what attracted others. People knew that Chico was there for them because his dreams included them. Lower East Side was his place, his natural habitat. He felt alive there. He could not walk through Midtown or Wall Street without feeling cold and numb. He had to return to Lower East Side to find the warmth. Angela Lopez, a young woman who worked with him at the center, spoke next. Pedro is right. We need bread and roses, art and housing. The deal is this, though. This ain't no low-income housing project. It's a smokescreen for the gentrifiers. Brother nailed it on the head when he said we need both, but we ain't getting neither with this deal. I bet our fucking councilman's making out like a bandit, though. Turns out, he's the developer. A grumble rose from the crowd. Everybody get it now? It's a scam, big time. What you want to do about it, people? What are we gonna do about it? We gotta get together, can't be fighting each other. Got to focus on the enemy. There's lots of other places to build housing. Can't let them take El Jardin. Right on, vaya, and talk about it, girlfriend rang through the auditorium. Chico sensed a spirit in the crowd that hadn't been there before. Thank you. We still have some time if people have questions or want to talk, or I could read a little more. You don't have to. Nothing? Should I read? Yes, Damien.
Just interested in how did this experience that you had in the 70s affect the thoughts on avenues for change after that? It seems that when you guys were involved in this activity, quite a few of you were writing about kind of community development and the possibilities of retrofitting and all kinds of social ecological creativity could occur. And then in the kind of later decades, that seemed to disappear as a kind of a rhyme discourse, at least.
Well,
is that related to your experience?
I would say that for me personally, working on the Lower East Side with the community groups there, it was a formative experience. And it was, I co-founded the Institute for Social Ecology back in the 70s, and we got involved with a number of community groups doing community development work and utilizing alternative technology and creating community gardens and various stuff. Some of it is actually, I don't know if the slideshow is still running, but you can see the solar collectors on the roof and the windmills and some of the gardens. And it was just, as I said, a formative experience for me. It really reinforced for me the power of grassroots activity, and given the history of the Lower East Side, really convinced me that the only way meaningful community development can occur is if it happens from the grassroots. And there need to be ways to marshal resources, human energy, and other kinds of resources to facilitate that kind of work. And a lot of that was happening during that period at in the Lower East Side. By the mid-80s, I think a lot of that energy was diverted, because that was when gentrification really began with a vengeance. And essentially, folks had to make the priority trying to save what was left of the neighborhood. And it meant some of the more reconstructive stuff was sort of placed on the back burner. For me personally, my own writing I wrote my doctoral dissertation about my experience on the Lower East Side. So that's something that in terms of writing came out of it, and there's some analysis in there of what I saw as the tremendous strengths of the movement and some of the obstacles that it was facing. So, yes?
It's almost exactly 30 years since I visited Cape Farm at Goddard College when the Institute of Social Ecology was based there, and that was my countercultural homecoming experience. Mm-hmm. It changed my life and led to just so much.
Oh, well.
I'm curious to hear about the history of how that remarkable experiment at Goddard College came together, and I heard that summer program ended, and any news about what became the Institute?
Sure. Well, the Institute is still going strong, actually. We started at Goddard College back in 1974. We had a farm that the college owned that we developed as our, it was our classroom, and it was a experiment. It was a demonstration project, and we incorporated a lot of what were really brand new kinds of alternative technologies there, wind power, solar energy, organic gardening, organic aquaculture, closed system, this and that, you know, all kinds of stuff that was really pretty cutting edge then. And it's a great irony for me personally to see now that, you know, so much of what's being proposed to save our economy and deal with global warming and stuff, you know, if they'd listened to us 40 years ago, we wouldn't be in this mess now. And of course, the way that it's being introduced today is through corporate capitalist models, and that was not what we envisioned. We really saw these technologies as having tremendous application at a community scale where they could be controlled by the community and controlled democratically and really enhance the self-reliance of local communities in both urban and rural settings. And for me, the Lower East Side, the work that went on in Lower East Side, it was the most developed expression of that, honestly. So anyway, we were at Goddard College for about 10 years. And then the college experienced financial difficulty, and we became independent of them and moved around a bunch. And then we eventually, in 1997 or 98, I guess, after 10 years of just renting facilities for the Institute, we bought a farm up in Vermont. And we started developing that as another demonstration site and educational center. The Institute was offering a graduate program and an undergraduate program. And our big annual event was a summer program where we'd draw a good number of students. So we continued at the farm there. I stepped down. As I said, I co-founded the Institute. I was the executive director for 32 years. And I wanted to write a novel and play music and do some other stuff because I was also teaching full time. Between the two, there was much time for anything else. So I stepped down at that point, and the Institute kept the farm going for another couple years after that, and then it just financially wasn't working. So we sold the farm. But currently, I encourage you to check out the website, which is Institute for Social Ecology. It's pretty active now. They've got some lively discussions going on, some of the old debates, some of the stuff that I would have hoped that books like Damien's had sort of put in perspective and laid to rest or sort of reemerging. But it's a generational thing, I guess. And so we have the website going. We have an MA program that we do with Prescott College. We have upcoming this summer what's being called, I don't know, what's Brooke calling it, do you know, Blair? A program, a week-long sort of introductory program, social ecology, that's going to be offered. And then every summer we do a colloquium up in Vermont for people who are sort of, you know, really immersed in this stuff to get together and hash out ideas and issues. And we have a climate justice project that we're doing. We've got a lot of our people are publishing some good stuff now. Brian Tokar particularly publishing some very important work about climate justice issues primarily, and did a lot of work around genetic engineering for the Institute as well. So that's sort of in a nutshell what's happening now. But we are still going, and if anyone's interested, I'd encourage you to check the website out and get involved if you'd like. Yes.
I suppose this would be more up to our generation to define, but I was wondering if you can, like, if you've identified like a new Lower East Side anymore, or if this kind of movement is happening somewhere. You say it's kind of gone to the Garden in Vermont. That experiment seems to be taken out, but is there kind of a new Islam?
No, that was a
waiver. I think they're interestingly, we saw a big resurgence of interest in this stuff just in the past few years, particularly when Obama came in. You know, he was promoting alternative technology, this and that. He hired this guy, Van Jones, who the Fox News got rid of quickly. And my understanding was that Van Jones, who's actually somebody who came out of the movement, which is probably why he was fired, was trying to reintroduce a lot of these ideas as a model for community development nationally. I don't know where those efforts are right now. I know of some individual projects going on, places that seem promising and interesting, but I don't know of a neighborhood that sort of coalesced around these ideas in a way that's analogous to what was happening back in the 70s. And it's a shame. And it is up to you, young people.
I like this particular passage. He knew he had returned to his place, the margins, where change happens, where energy is transformed, and where new species emerge, the edge, the source, the estuary, where the river meets the sea. We've combined both the social and the ecological. And is that necessary for a community like Loisaida?
I mean, that's why I believe in social ecology. I think every environmental problem is really a social problem. It's not first nature. It's not nature without the impact of humanity that's creating these problems for us. It's our society and our social relations and the sort of underlying structures of capitalism and hierarchy and domination. The domination, Murray Bookchin has always said, and I would agree with him, that the domination of nature only emerges after people dominate other people. So they're inextricably linked. And we're not going to solve ecological problems until we solve these social problems.
Is change going to come from the margins?
I think that's where change always comes from, to be honest with you. Case in point, you know, if we ever do get a carbon-free economy going, it was people who were totally marginalized back in the late 60s and early 70s who first started developing and introducing these technologies. And believe me, we were ridiculed for it. You know, they thought it was a big joke. Chino.
Yeah, the whole question of energy and alternative energy is one of the, and abortion is the two things that have been holding back the budget, which is like a, I mean, according to the budget of the United States, it's miserable what they are talking about. Yeah. And those are the two main issues that have been holding back the settlement of the budget. So energy, ecology, all that stuff is very important in our lives. You know, I mean, the whole United States cannot operate until they make that deal on those particular two points. You know, so.
Yeah, and it's really, I mean, now we have climate deniers. You know, it's like being a Holocaust denier. It is. You know, I mean, there's all of this evidence and all of this weight of opinion that tells us that it's happening and it's real. And these guys who are running the Congressional Energy Committee, you know, saying, oh, you don't have to worry about global warming. God promised Noah in the Bible there would be no more floods. So we're all right. Don't worry. You know? So, yeah. Scary. Anything else? Okay. Well, thank you all for coming. I really appreciate it. And let me make a pitch. I do have some books here. I'd be happy to sign them if anybody wants one. And I also brought some other material from my press. My publisher has just started this press. I'm among his first seven titles. And he's, I think, trying to do something really interesting and maybe unique today, because he wants to publish literary fiction and poetry, but he wants it to be political. So I think we need more of that. Thanks.